So we're recording. Ha ha ha. That cheap special effect there. This is Mentioned in Dispatches. We're recording on a slightly off night because we had to accommodate our special guest who wanted to do some wacky video broadcast something or other last night. So Mo from Mo's Game Table is back. Howdy, Mo.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, I was watching the it's funny, my wife looked at what it was on there. She knows the podcast term from me doing the podcast, but she happened to see over my shoulder when I was washing the dishes and watching you guys. And she said, "What is that, a quadcast?" And she was very impressed with her own cleverness because there were the four of you guys on the broadcast last night when you were interviewing Luke Hughes. So had a good time watching you guys and, you know, interacting on that. But because of that, we had to bump our recording an extra night, and it won't matter to any of our listeners because this won't show up for like another 2 weeks.
Oh, that's good. I mean, it was a lot of fun having you in there. It was a lot of fun talking to Luke and talking about Burden of Command. And, you know, we actually even won a game, and then you said, "No, I'm going to hand that off to the other guy who did not get a chance," because he kind of, I don't know what it was, but I made the point of saying, "Hey, he wasn't paying attention because it's like he must have just woke up or something." And he's like, "Oh, man, I just missed it." And then you said, "You know, I let him have it."
Yeah, I've got a backlog here of stuff that I've got still to play. I'm still working through World at War 85 because I want to get another good playthrough or two on that before I write the review. Look, I've been playing the World at War 85 series since it was just World at War and the original Eisenbach Gap before Death of First Panzer got incorporated and re-released as the deluxe edition. I've been on that game since the beginning, but there are enough changes and tweaks and alterations that I want to make sure I've got several good playthroughs before I finish that review. And once that gets off the table, I've got like eight other games stacked up waiting to go. So as cool as it would have been to get, it was Last 100 Yards, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Last 100 Yards by Mike Danson.
Yeah, as cool as it would have been to be able to score a copy of Last 100 Yards as a, you know, a winner giveaway thing there, it would have gone like 12th in the queue of stuff I've got at this point at the earliest. And I didn't feel right like taking that from one of the other guys that was there wanting it. So, you know, send it to him. I hope he enjoys the hell out of it.
It was really cool of you to do that. I mean, it was one of those things where I've been doing it, you know, especially with this whole virus thing going on. Everyone's stuck at home and, you know, we're all just kind of like, everyone's kind of tired of hearing about the virus, thinking about the virus and being home and trying to play games and trying to keep your sanity and everything else. And you know, I was like, "Hey, we're going to have these really cool interviews. We're going to discuss stuff with different people, have really cool quadcasts." I'm going to now have to trademark that, but we're going to have to, you know, keep everybody entertained. And, you know, I figured for the hell of it, I'll just throw in some giveaways. And I gave away a game last show, and then this show I didn't even say anything about it until later in the show, and I was like, "Well, we're talking about tactical games here, so who wants a copy of Last 100 Yards in shrink?" And everyone was like, you know, quiet for a second, and you're like, me. So I was like, "All right, Brent gets it." And then everybody woke up, like, I guess they must have been like not paying attention or where they could type, because there was like a delay of, I don't know, about 30 seconds a minute after you responded. Then other people started responding, like, "Oh, I missed it." It's like, "Hey, you gotta be quick on the fingers there, man. You gotta type on that keyboard quick."
Yep. Gotta get, and I wasn't even on a keyboard. I was on my cell phone.
You just hit ME about 12 times.
Yeah. Well, you throw me a contest opportunity and I'll jump on it somehow. So,
well, I thought it was funny. I thought you were doing a warm up or something like that with it. Yeah.
And I'm the guy that needs it the least, you know, given the backlog of stuff that I've got. And in addition to the regular backlog of stuff that I've got here, one of our dudes who's been clearing it, he recently bought a new house and has been sort of unpacking and clearing and pruning his game collection a little bit, sent me the whole stack of the Millennium Wars collection from OSS. So I've got those in a stack here as well. So it's not really like new stuff that I have to get to sometime soon. He just knows that I really like the modern games, and so he sent those to me.
Sure.
Yeah, so I've got plenty of stuff to keep me occupied if we've got somebody else out there that can get a hold of the Last 100 Yards and enjoy it. You know, I got no problem letting another gamer get his crack at it.
Yeah, so. And it's a really cool system. I mean, Mike really has hit on something unique and interesting because, you know, every tactical game or tactical system runs pretty much the same. You know, I mean, not exactly the same, but they're very similar, you know, and if you play one, you can easily, fairly easy, learn the others because they follow the same, you know, modus operandi, shall
yeah,
we say.
Yeah.
But this one's different because you have to think differently, because you're basically programming everything, for lack of a better term, by, you know, running through all of your steps. This guy's going to do this. This guy's going to do that. And, you know, the initiative guy is going to be doing everything. The other guy's just going to be reacting, and then you're trying to get the initiative away, but it's difficult to do. And then you put all your modifiers out, then you resolve everything. And at first, when you hear it, you're like, that sounds kind of stupid, you know? And then you're like, you play it and you're like, wow, it's actually pretty brilliant,
yeah.
You know? And then you're like, this is really cool. And Mike has really hit on something very unique. And it's great for us to have these designs coming out. And this is his first design. So I'm really excited to see what else he's got, you know, tucked away in his mind.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool to see new designers break some new ground and see the twists on them. You mentioned some things are pretty similar to each other. I think it gets to the point, especially some of those tactical systems, where it's a lot of folks understand the basic sort of move, shoot, opportunity, fire, that I go, you go sort of. Even when folks try to make it sound like some kind of simultaneous move something, there's still some tweaks in there that a lot of things are very similar, and it's almost more learning the exceptions, right? Oh, in this system you do this thing, whereas in this other system you're going to use this other modifier. But a lot of very similar, like you said, a lot of very similar mechanics, in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it definitely very similar. And then there are some that are very unique, you know, like, for example, some people may say that's not a tactical system, you know, but it is, like the Warfighter system. It's a card game, but it's very tactical. You know, it is surprisingly tactical, I should say, because you have to make decisions as you're kind of pressing your luck, which is, you know, when you look at it, you kind of do the something similar in a tactical game. You're always pushing your luck. It's like, yeah. Okay, yeah, you can math it out and say, I need to have this, you know, combine all these guys here to get this 3-1 odds to be to be able to win, get a shift left or whatever. In Warfighter, you're kind of doing the same thing, but a little bit differently. And it's a lighter game. It's fast and it's easy to play, and it's a lot of fun. And kind of like Band of Brothers, that's kind of a lighter, fast, easy to play game.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's something for everybody. There's a ton of different tactical systems out there to enjoy.
I'm going to put my foot down here slightly on the Warfighter thing. It's DVG's Warfighter system, because the original Warfighter system,
yes,
was actually published by Bayonet Games back in 2005 when Movement to Contact came out and was followed up by the Guards and then Maneuver Warrior. And has had Asian Thunder on the drawing board for a while now. But the Bayonet Games Warfighter system beat DVG's Warfighter system to the market by at least 5 years. So
nice.
Yeah,
so
it was out for a while.
You're going to have it out with Dan over, you know, the rights to the name?
Not at this point. It's kind of immaterial, since Bayonet Games hasn't really done anything other than be my email address for the past decade. Look, I was never a great business dude, but the combination of grad school and job hunting completely torpedoed any momentum that I had 10 years ago. And it's just been way too much. It would have been way too much of a time sink to try and restart that, when I've also been in the process of running other wargaming websites and doing other things. You know, look, like, you do hockey on the side. I've got a local internet radio station here that I work with on the side, on top of everything else that I'm doing. So,
sure.
At some point you run out of time and something's got to go. And in this case, the Bayonet Games stuff went, not because I wasn't interested in still doing game design stuff, but anybody that ends up running a wargaming company or any kind of game company very quickly realizes that while you think you are in the game publishing business, you are actually in the shipping business.
Yes.
You will spend more time at a post office than you will doing anything else in that company. And that started to wear on me some. So at some point, will some of those designs see the light of day with a different publisher? Maybe. If I get motivated enough to finish them, sure. But I haven't been there in half a decade. And at this point, anybody that brings up Warfighter or anything immediately thinks of Dan's system, not mine, even though mine was on the cover of Paper Wars magazine. But, life goes on.
Well, that's the thing. You know, we all have these delusions of grandeur. We go out and we buy these monster games. We get these things. Oh, we get these nice big monster games. We touch them and we, you know, lovingly open up the rule book and look at the rules. Like, oh, this is going to be such a great game. This is going to be wonderful. When is it ever going to get to the table should actually be the first question you ask yourself honestly, and you realize 3 to 6 months, a year, it depends, yeah. Maybe a con. You know, it's Romeo Lima gets in the way. Real life always screws up all our plans.
The guys over at Thin Red Line with their World War III games, the 60 Miles and Under an Iron Sky. I think they got another one coming out soon, too.
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got the Scandinavian one, Sweden.
Those things are Northern Lights. Yeah, those things are so right in the wheelhouse of what I love. That whole Cold War goes hot in Europe kind of thing. Look, I lived there in the 80s. Like, my dad was in the military, but still, I was living there. Like, I lived this stuff. You know, if the balloon had gone up in 85, I was there. It would have happened. Would have happened to me. Like, I wasn't in uniform, but it's not like the Yeah, they had a plan to supposedly evacuate the non-combatant civilians. We weren't leaving. Like, we knew we weren't leaving. On top of that, I was a fluent German speaker, right? There was no way I was leaving. I was going to end up getting put to work on something somewhere. Like, nobody wants to say, yeah, we're going to put a 15-year-old in a unit or something. But the reality is, I fluent German speaker who knows the American military, they would have found something to do with me. Totally. It's just reality, right? That's just the reality of what was going to happen. And we know that because it happened in World War II with English speakers that were living in France and the Netherlands. So, that kind of scenario, you know, you look at my shelves of the stuff that I've got, the old West End Fire Team game, the World at War series, you know, the Team Yankee, Battlefield Europe. I mean, that is my game collection. Like, that's what I've got on the shelf over here. And you know, Air and Armor is over there on the shelf. I'm trying to eyeball around other clutter.
Did you hear, speaking of Air and Armor, I actually, when I was interviewing John Kranz at CSW, did you hear what he had to say? I don't know if you'd heard it any other way, but
they're bringing it back.
He said, yeah, they're definitely bringing it back, and it's actually jumped the queue, so we're going to see it faster.
Cool.
Although now with everything going on, it may still be a little slow.
Yeah. Somewhere in that stack, I've got TAC Air over there. You know, it's just... You get the point. That's what I dig. That's my primary love. The Assault series, the Third World War series, you know, Third World War series is coming back. So those things from Thin Red Line would be so perfectly right in what I would do. But then you look at the list of components and the scenarios and everything, and you're like, holy crap. I mean, that's like Case Blue size big.
Oh, it is.
Look, I am fortunate that I have the office over the garage. That's where I'm sitting here recording this. You know, this is my own. It's a 400 square foot mini studio apartment out here. I have the space to set it up and leave it up. I got nobody around here to play that with.
Yeah.
Like, even if I did get it all set up and ready to go, what am I going to do? Like, hold a webcam up to you to say, all right, your turn. What do you want to do? You
know? It's like, well, I got it too. I have that in less than 60 miles as well. I'm going to get, you know, Northern Lights and, you know, just because it's, I feel the same way, you know, that Third World War, that hypothetical is right up my alley. It's where my interest is. When I'll get to play it, I'm not sure. It's just one of those things where I'm going to have, you know, Kev Sharp from Big Board, he's always like, throw dice, man, just get it down. He's actually really good at getting games in and just open them up. He'll even do a shrink rip video, and he literally, I could just see, he does the shrink rip, and then he's like, okay guys, see ya, bye. He, you know, uploads the video, and while the video's uploading, he's actually tearing the game apart prior, just starting to read the rules and start throwing it down on the table. It's like, damn, I wish I could do that. I just don't have the time.
Yeah.
And I end up, you know, okay, I'm going to get to this, and then I look at the rules, and I'm like, I really want to get to this someday, but every time I want to set it up, I know that this is going to need to be sitting here for a few weeks because I'm going to be playing it solitaire. I'm not going to be playing it multiplayer.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's going to have to be a convention game.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the whole thing with all this is that those things are going to turn into convention games for me. And is it worth that kind of money to have it just as a convention game? And probably not. I mean, I hate to say that. That's the reality
of
it.
Look at it. The reason I get that is the same reason I got Jaws of Victory, you know, from New England Simulations. I had heard a lot of great things about it. You know, NES has a great reputation. So I was like, you know what? I'm thinking of getting this. It's Eastfront. I'm liking it. And somebody said to me on Facebook, and I think the Wargamers group or something said, if you're considering it, don't consider it too long. Just get it because when they go out of print, they're out of print.
Yeah, so exactly.
all right, you know, it's kind of the same thing with, you know, Under an Iron Sky and Less Than 60 Miles. These are, you know, small publishers. They yeah. make a small print run. Get it now because, yeah, right now you may say, oh, I'm probably not going to play it, but you never know. In a year or 2 years, you may go, oh, man, I should have got that game. Yeah. I could play it right now. This would have been perfect. And you'd be kicking yourself. So I'd rather not kick myself and say, yeah, you know, I got it. Eventually, someday I'll get to play it.
I think Under an Iron Sky happened to hit at one point when I was between jobs, and so the money was not going to line up no matter what. Yeah. Less Than 60 Miles, I probably should have grabbed and just and didn't because, you know, the whole trade-off between, you know, what does it cost, when am I going to get to play it, and now you're going to make me hate myself for passing it up, so thanks. Appreciate
well,
you.
Less Than 60 was like $100, so it was a little bit more manageable than, you know, a lot more manageable than, you know,
Iron Sky was like 175 or something, wasn't it?
It was like, I think, 2 or 240, something like that. It was not cheap.
Yeah, it was kind of insane.
But component-wise, it's, you know, pretty awesome, and there's a tremendous amount of depth in there. There's a lot of game in that box, so it's definitely, I think it, from what I've gathered from looking at the rules and seeing other people talking about the game, you know, I've shown some videos, Kev has done some videos and stuff, and I think he's even mentioned it himself, that it kind of leans more to simulation than it does to game, you know, and that's actually pretty cool, because sometimes you want to play a game, sometimes you want to play a sim, you know, and, you know, you want to simulate, say, hey, what would have happened in this situation? You know, now that we know more than we did back then, you know, now you can actually have possibly a better representation of what would have transpired.
You brought up one of my pet topics right there that folks that listened to this past week's podcast with Red Powell will, I say this past week, as we're recording it, it was this past week. By the time people are hearing this, it'll be like 3 weeks gone. Where do you draw a distinction between game and sim?
I think every game is a game. Not every game is a simulation. And even a simulation is a game. Because it's still a game. You're not actually truly representing exactly historical situations. You may simulate or re-simulate, I should say, like the D-Day landings or something. But it's still a game. You're still gaming it out. But a simulation to me is, you know, I think when you really get down to rivet counting, you know, and you get into much more hardcore details, you're not looking to balance play. You're actually saying, here are the forces that played, or that not played, here are the forces that fought in this battle. This is the situation they encountered. Now recreate, you know, see what the outcome is. And if it's identical, then okay, it's a pretty damn good simulation of you know, accurately representing the conflict. If it changes differently, then you have to analyze, what did you do different? You know, did you maybe release troops faster or, you know, release your reserves, you know, sooner and bring them into the battle. Did they go later? You know, things like that. You have to then analyze what you did differently from the historical counterpart, from your historical counterparts. And then you can really weigh the differences between your outcome and their outcome. And that's, you know, one of those things where I think simulation is more of the, you know, like I said, bean counter and the mathematician type of really deep detailed, looking at the supply, the exact troop strength and their size. Whereas a game is going to say, yeah, you know what? These guys were kind of like this, but they're going to steamroll everybody. So we're going to change this. We're going to drop them down one strength point or give these guys an extra strength point or limit them some way. Cause you're mitigating, somebody from being just a steamroller, you know, because you want to make it a game, and simulation is not going to look to do that.
I'm asking because this has been a long running discussion between me and James Sterrett.
Sure.
We used to, for a long time when we were working with the War College at Origins, we used to, every year we'd run a panel on games and sims for military training. And one of the guaranteed conversation starters that we used for about 4 or 5 years in a row is, okay, so what do you think the difference is between a game and a sim? And we'd throw that out there as the conversation starter and then sort of let it go from there. And we've been sort of banging at each other over this for over a decade now. So, Red Powell made a comment about, you know, something being more of a game than a sim. And so I seized on that immediately and I could feel James rolling his eyes through the podcast and like, oh great, here we go again.
Well, you know what?
You threw Bran a bone.
What's the difference between a game and a simulation? That's when you throw back in them. It's Twilight Struggle of War Game. You know, it's like, okay, let's have this, you know, nonstop banter back and forth. I think it really, in the end, it comes down to, it's in the eye of the beholder. You know, what is it you're looking for? You know, some people would, you know, the OCS guys would probably say OCS is a simulation, you know, because it does simulate to a larger degree than any other game the supply portion of operational combat. And, you know, like me, I've never played OCS. I don't really have much of an interest in playing OCS because of the fact that everything I've heard about it is, you know, it's very much a management game. And that sounds interesting and fascinating. Not my cup of tea. I want to get in there and fight. You know, I just want to get in there and fight. It's like, yeah, okay, make supply is, you know, kind of abstract. You can make it a little involved, but I don't want to spend too much of my time worrying about supply. I just want to get in there and fight. The supply to me is for the log train guys. Let them deal with that stuff. I'm there to fight.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I've argued about over the years is that games and sims are not mutually exclusive. There is a significant overlap. And really where I think it, so I did a bunch of this in the academic side as well, because I did a lot of my PhD research and the dissertation I'd been working on when I ran out of money, was built around varying levels of interactivity and training and learning. And so at what point do you sort of top out on the value of interactivity in the learning, and does interactivity actually get in the way in some cases of the kinds of things you want people to learn? And so one of the big distinctions that I drew in there, at least through the literature that I had studied and the way that I was approaching things, games are an inherently competitive exercise, right? Sure. A game, you're looking for a winner and a loser. And so, you know, when you're playing basketball, you've got a winner and a loser. When you're playing golf, you've got a winner and a loser. Like, you've got a score out there. But if you're just out in the yard playing catch, you're still throwing a baseball around, but it's not really a winner and a loser. You're just playing catch. One of the great examples of that is on the computer, there are flight sims that you're just flying stuff around. That's not, we call it a game just as a shorthand thing, because it's still an interactive video thing you're doing on a computer, and the easy shorthand that the public has for that is that that's a game. Without any sort of win condition or victory condition or scorekeeping, that's not really a game. Now, Microsoft has grafted some gamification onto some of their flight sims in terms of how clean is your takeoff, how clean is your landing, how, you know, how smooth are your banks and your turns, that you can put some artificial scoring on. And at that point, now it becomes a game. But in the meantime, you're just flying a plane around. That's a sim. That's not a game. Because the game is an inherently competitive thing. The flip side of that is that a simulation is a level of complexity and an attempt to reflect reality.
Yeah.
And so you can have very complicated simulations that are attempting to reflect reality that have a scorekeeping mechanism on them, and now you have a simulation that is a game.
Sure.
But that's not, you can have simulations that aren't games, and you can have games that aren't simulations. And so, you know, whenever people start talking about, well, it's more of a game than a simulation, or it's, you know, what I love is in the wargaming world, people talk about it's more of a sim than a game. Well, you're still keeping score. It's a game.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, there's one game, I can't remember off the top of my head what the name of it is. I keep thinking Space Flight Simulator. That's not the one. That's a Microsoft one. But there is another one. I think it's still in pre-release, you know, like early release or whatever you call that on Steam, where you are piloting an Apollo space flight. Mm-hmm. And that's a simulation, because you're sitting there and you're literally toggling all the same switches, running the same programs that the Apollo astronauts did on takeoff. And it goes so far as, you know, it even simulates the shake of the cabin on takeoff, because everyone, you know, maybe people don't realize how violent that thing is to ride, you know, until it smooths out. But it just shakes real hard, and it's difficult to reach those switches. They go through all this training to do all this stuff ahead of time and know where to reach. And it simulates that. Now, you can turn that off and gamify it, you know, say, yeah, I don't want the shake because it moves my mouse all over the place. It makes it difficult to, you know, to play. It's frustrating.
Yeah.
Well, you can do that. It's like, no, but that's kind of cool. And on that, for that aspect, I like that, because you're reliving and recreating a really special, you know, event, a special feat that we accomplished as humans.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very easy to sort of see that distinction between game versus sim when you're talking digital stuff, right? When you went through your tank driver training, right? You had to sit in the giant spider pod that, you know, when the tank turned, the pod kind of turned. And I mean, it's,
no, we didn't have that.
You didn't do the tank driving simulators?
Nope. Our tank driving simulators was put your ass in a seat. Here we go.
Yeah, here you go. So at Fort Knox in the early and mid 90s, they were rolling out these tank pods. It's a one man pod. You sit in there, you kind of lay down in it, and it's the driver station of an M1 tank. And it's articulated on these six hydraulic arms, so it can tilt three different directions, and it moves with you as you're moving along. And
that's that SimNet stuff, isn't it?
Well, no. So SimNet was a little different. This was a driver specific training tool.
Just the driver.
This was just the driver. SimNet had
that was for the whole crew.
SimNet had the whole crew, and so there was a separate driver station, and then there was a turret station that had room for the TC, the gunner, and the loader. You were in there doing your thing. Where the big difference, SimNet, the video screens changed so you could see different things for what was going on, but the vehicle didn't move. It wasn't on hydraulics that sort of bounced you around. The whole point of the driver's trainer was that it did bounce you around. When you had to bank, it banked for you so you would feel what these things felt like. If you were going up a hill, you would get greater resistance on the T-bar. And it was kind of like some of those driving simulators. Look, like the NASCAR guys, because sports are all out right now, the NASCAR guys are doing these simulated races sitting at a driver's station simulator. They're not holding Xbox controllers. I mean, they're actually sitting in a driver's seat with a wheel and a stick shift and everything else.
Yeah.
Nice. Which is actually kind of cool. Like, you've actually got something sports-ish on TV.
that's cool.
But that's what that driver simulator did. And so that's very clearly a simulator. Like, unless you're doing tank races, there's nothing inherently competitive about that.
You're taking something that is really, you're taking a multi-million-dollar piece of equipment, and just like what a flight simulator for pilots, you can put them in a situation, a really dangerous situation, safely by putting them in there, whether it's military or a civilian aircraft.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, on the digital side, the it's very easy to see something as a simulator that does not have an inherent game built on top of it. That's real easy to envision. It's a little tougher on a tabletop because you're losing some of that simulation fidelity. But whenever folks start talking about something being more of a game than a simulation, I always sort of, the antenna go up, and it's like, you know, maybe it's the academic background in me, but when you start talking about how to use some of these definitions, you mentioned the whole, you know, the inevitable argument of is Twilight Struggle a war game. Sometimes a lot of that pedantic discussion is completely irrelevant to whether or not you have fun playing the game, right? And that's really what we should care about is do people enjoy playing the game? But where I had come through, you know, a bunch of years in grad school of dealing with games in these training and learning environments, you needed that level of pedantic distinction in order to accurately assess the effects you were looking for these things. If you're going to go in somewhere and say, hey, I've got this training program that I think you should be adopting, you've got to be able to demonstrate some sort of quantifiable success. And you've got to be able to say, this kind of thing gives you this level of result, this other kind of thing gives you this level of result, based on your starting population. And so you need those kinds of very finely sliced distinctions that, quite frankly, nobody in the hobby game world gives a crap about.
The other thing, too, that, you know, you hit on it just a moment ago is very true. You know, it's easier to have a simulation in the digital space than it is in a board game for one simple fact right off the bat. When you're dealing with a board game, you're pretty much dealing with, you know, God mode. You are seeing everything, especially if you're playing solitaire. You know everything that's on the table, unless you're like me and you go, okay, I'm going to stack these guys. I'm going to forget what they are in about 30 seconds. So it'll be like a surprise when, that is the Uber stack. But when you're doing it with digital, it's all run by the computer. So the only way really to have good simulation on a board game aspect would be to have a refereed game, because then you are truly dealing with fog of war, friction, and all of the unknowns that you will deal with in a tabletop side of things that you would deal with in combat. So that's when it would raise more to the simulation level, or could raise to the simulation level more than a game.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of God mode stuff we've talked about in other discussions in the past. One way around that, of course, is some of the double blind stuff, Kriegspiel being the original double blind, but there's plenty of other things that you can modify just about any of those games to run double blind if you need to.
Yeah.
I really think you're right in that you do lose that God mode is really important. I think one of the bigger issues in all of that is there's a level of sensory input that is so different on a tabletop from anything that the computer can give you that sure. the simulation capabilities of the computer are just so much higher just because of the various sensory inputs that you can't get in a board game. And that's not a bad thing. That's just, you know, it's different. It's, you know, it's different the difference medium. Between music yeah. and pasta. I mean, they're just different, you know.
That's very true. You know, you can get into a computer game and you can have, you know, like you were just saying about the NASCAR guys. You can get yep. in there. I used to do some online racing as well, and you can get in there with like a force feedback, you know, wheel. And, you know, some of these guys have like little cockpits that they've built and everything else where, you know, if you get crazy and you got the money and you can build a cockpit that'll move, you know, well then, hey, you are really at that point, you're taking your racing game and you're turning it into a simulation because you are having – you know, the effects, you're feeling some of the effects, not the G's, but you're feeling some of the torque on your body, you're feeling the feedback through your hands, and that the wheel is not as easy to move as it normally would be, it's a lot stiffer, things like that, which makes it a lot more enjoyable and challenging.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mentioned earlier the NASCAR dudes, that's exactly what they do. Like, to be a part of those NASCAR races, you've got to have a certain kind of simulator at home that includes the feedback on the wheel when you're in the tight turn, that you have to shift the gears and everything. It's almost like one of the training tools that they use at the tracks where they teach you how to drive like that. They put you in one of those simulators. Same thing with a, you know, like a flight simulator. Before we're going to give you the keys to a real airplane, we're going to make you do a bunch of takeoffs and landings and these things first. So in order to participate in this NASCAR iRacing thing, you have to have that same rig at home that everybody else does. And, sure. And so, you know, that levels the playing field for those guys, which is, you know, still kind of cool. That kind of thing doesn't, there's no analog to that in the board game world.
No,
it just doesn't.
You know, the funny thing is I've done, like I said, I've done the online racing stuff. I've, you know, I haven't done it in years, but I had done that in the past. And then I had gotten the opportunity for my 40th birthday. My father-in-law, he had bought me a ride at Texas Motor Speedway. And I was like, oh, this is going to be cool. It's a ride along. It's like, oh, no. It's not a ride along. You're driving the car.
You're driving.
And I was like, sweet. So I get there and I'm like, it was a combination of this is going to be awesome and the adrenaline's kicking in. I was like, it's going to be great. This is going to be scary at the same time. And I was like, no, that wasn't scary at all. It was so much like the racing sims. It was not funny because, you know, those sims are really good at you know, following the physics of the lines around the track.
Yep.
And the cars are set up in such a way that, you know, it's very – they're very easy to set into the turns. And then you basically just – you learn your point. Out of the throttle, into the throttle. It was a Texas Motor Speedway, so it's a pretty simple dogleg track. And you just get out to the wall, you let off the throttle, get down into the turn, set, get back in the throttle, you know, and just do the same thing every way around.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun, you know, and I was like, wow, this is a lot smoother than I thought. The coolest part, though, was getting past and then passing a guy.
Yeah.
And it was just a unique experience. You know, you understand drafting, you understand how that works, but you don't really appreciate it until you do it. And then you're like, wow, yeah, there's the closure rate. Holy crap, yeah, now I'm getting around them.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Suddenly I see how this works.
Yes. And it's like, yeah, it definitely gives you a different appreciation for the bump drafting and all that stuff those guys do, because you can see as the cars, as you get into that draft, you can feel that the car gets pulled, and at the same time, it is much more touchy than you think it would be. So it wouldn't take much to get you loose, you know, and us not being race car drivers, we'd be up in the wall. So thankfully they set it in such a way where you get a touch of the draft and then they tell you to pull around, you know,
yeah.
Don't get too close. You pull around, but you get enough of an appreciation.
And there's no way to replicate anything remotely like that on a tabletop, right?
No,
if you've played any of the racing games, you know, that's just Thunder Alley doesn't give you that same experience.
No. And you know, even if you play it on the computer games, what it ends up doing is you end up wrecking it like Talladega or something like that. You're like, wow, that's cool. Look at all the error I caught. You know, you're watching the replay of it, not the reality of, wow, that would really suck to be thrown up in the air like that and hit the wall and then get T-boned by somebody. You know, that would be rather uncomfortable. But, you know, that's where the video game stuff makes it a lot of fun.
Yeah, and have to get, like, scraped off the pavement, you know.
Yeah.
Rather not.
No, definitely don't want to do that.
You mentioned the God mode with the board games. To me, that's always been one of the God mode issue for me has been a lot less about I can see where everything is on the map, because that's a given in the board game world. Like, unless you're using the blocks or something, there's only so much you can hide in a board game at all. The, sure. To me, the bigger issue with it all is as soon as I open the box, there are so many questions that are instantly answered, right? If we're playing Gettysburg, there's no option to like flip the battlefield and have the Union defend the opposite end of the battlefield. Like, if you're playing Gettysburg, these are the directions the two guys came from. They hit at Gettysburg. This is the only terrain option you've got to you. There's not really an option for the Battle of Gettysburg to take place 10 miles up the road because the timing got thrown off slightly at the operational level. And, sure. And that fight is slightly, and so to me, there's a lot of things that are so preordained as soon as the box gets open that there's some of those that I'm just like, you know, just don't need to do this.
But I know how that could change though. You let Ty Bomba do a Gettysburg game.
Yeah.
He'll throw in nukes and it'll be a what if situation.
Yes.
So there you go.
That is an option. Or, you know, we let Mark Walker do it and here come the werewolves.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it would be kind of cool to do stuff like that, especially Gettysburg Bulge and things like that, that are, you know, definitely they have more than one game made on them, but, it would be kind of neat if there was, some what ifs that were looked at differently from a historical aspect. It's like, well, if the Union was here rather than here, what if the Confederacy was here rather than here? What if they came with this many forces? They left behind this many forces, you know, actually trying to go with a more of an academic type of historical what if, like, you know, if a different decision was made and the Union only had this many forces committed and the Confederates only had this many, or they had a lot more or whatever, just to see what would happen, you know, in a what-if situation. And then you're gaming it out totally because it's ahistorical.
I think there are some games that give you some exploration tools to poke around that. I'm not sure enough of them do it as well as they could. But, you know, ultimately a lot – especially, like, it's one of the reasons I don't like a lot of American Civil War games. A lot of them don't appeal to me because they are almost such foregone conclusions. There were some battles in the Civil War that were fairly close run affairs, but a lot of them were almost decided at the operational level before the tactical fights ever really came into play. And that's why, you know, the high level strategic stuff. Who's Aardwolf busy playing the Victory Games Civil War one with? Navarone Gunn, I think is his screen name.
Okay.
The two of them have been live streaming a vassal game of Victory Games Civil War over the last week or so, every couple of nights. You know, at the strategic level, the Civil War is actually a fairly interesting game. But at the tactical level, like, I don't need to play a Gettysburg game to know. These are like the three things that need to happen if the Confederates are going to have a prayer of winning. And if you screw up any one of those three, you're toast. And you're toast because these are the only forces that are ever even in the counter mix out of the box. Like, what happens if Lee just waits an extra 2 days and gets a whole bunch of reinforcements show up? You know, he actually gets Jeb Stuart to show up somewhere on time. What happens if the 20th Maine takes a lunch break on the wrong day, you know, and they're not even in the battle? You know, it's easy to take guys out of the counter mix. It's a lot harder to put people in the counter mix when they're not even printed in there. Those things become kind of a big shrug for me. It's one of
the
things that I...
Semenich's Civil War game?
No, because again, it's Civil War stuff, and I generally steer clear of them because they just don't appeal to me all that much, so...
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I was just that it has such high marks, and everyone speaks so highly of the game that I was curious, you know, if you'd actually played it, being that you're like me, you're kind of like, it's Civil War, I'm not really into it. It's just not my area that I want to play. Just kind of like Napoleonic, same thing. It's like, I'm not really interested, but I will play the Revolutionary War games, you know, versus Napoleonics, and they're very similar, you know, same type of era, you know, same type of strategies and stuff, but it's just not my cup of tea. But I was just curious if you had played and what your thoughts were, because like I said, I hear nothing but great things about it.
No, I haven't, but again, it's not really my shtick. It's one of the reasons why something like a Squad Leader or a Lock and Load Tactical or a World at War 85, some of those are more interesting to me. Obviously, the hypotheticals are those never happen, so we don't know what would have, could have, should have happened in those. But even some of the World War II battles that you get in things like Squad Leader or Panzer Grenadier or something similar, you get enough of the different tactical situations, especially when you're using representational maps. Like the, what's the Squad Leader module that takes place in Budapest? Like it's, you know, it's the map of Budapest. There's no way around that. But you go back to the classic Squad Leader, you know, not advanced, but the original Squad Leader box, and you get out the Guards Counterattack module that we all learned on, you know, that first scenario there. That city ain't really Stalingrad, right? It's a representational urban map that's Stalingrad-ish, but it's not Stalingrad. And so you're not working from preordained terrain. You're not working from, you know, oh, you have to do this thing this way for this reason, the way you do with a lot of other games where you're on that Waterloo, right? I mean, there's only so many things you can do with Waterloo, you know, despite Jim Ozarski telling us, no, 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 there's plenty you can do. No, there's really only so many things you can do with Waterloo.
Well, that, the other thing, too, is, you know, you were saying about how, okay, this represented Stalingrad. It was a representation of Stalingrad. It was just, yeah, you know, we're going to slap Stalingrad name on it. People are going to buy it, and they're going to go, okay, cool. Gamers have gotten smarter and more historically influenced or, you know, whatever, rounded, I guess you could say, to where now people are knowing more and more about Stalingrad to where they go, oh, no, this didn't happen here. Where's the factory? Where's Pavlov's house? Where's all these different, you know, aspects of the battle itself that happened? You know, people are looking. They're drilling down into different areas. So if you make a game about Stalingrad and you want to make, you know, something that's, say, it's an accurate representation of the game, well, you better have the right places on the map because otherwise people are going to, you know, people are going to really complain about that.
Yeah, yeah. People will pitch fits. Absolutely.
Yeah, 30, 40 years ago, oh, yeah, I had a fight in Stalingrad. And it was like, you know, 20 hexes across or something like that. It's like, oh, yeah, this is the city of Stalingrad. It's like, no, that's one room.
Yeah.
You know?
That's this block of Stalingrad.
Yeah, exactly. But it depends on how abstract you want to be with it. But like I said, those games back then were different. Now they've gotten a lot more detailed, and they look at more details now than they did back then. For the most part, and people are demanding more.
We were talking earlier about a lot of tactical systems being very similar, and then you couple that with the fact that there are a lot of games on very similar topics, right? Sort of the magic 10 or 12 different topics of the Bulge, Waterloo, Gettysburg, right? I mean, we can go through these, Stalingrad, Waterloo. Like, we know what these games are that you get over and over and over. D-Day, we're going to get D-Day, Kursk, we're going to get a ton of those. I'd written a column a while back, and when I wrote the column, I was almost trying to convince myself. I wouldn't have admitted that when I first wrote it. It would have been like, I'm just trying to be a little provocative and see what people say. But, you know, now I'm a little more convinced that I might have actually been onto something. I think one of the reasons why having multiple games on the same topic, especially multiple systems that cover the same battles, are kind of a good thing is, take Gettysburg, for example. Like, we understand there are certain things that are key to Gettysburg, right? Little Round Top is a key piece of terrain. The Peach Orchard is a big deal. Like, what happens if you pull out of the Peach Orchard? You know, Chris is fond of talking about how they completely wrecked a Gettysburg game by just pulling out of the Peach Orchard, and the Union kind of went, oh, crap, now what? They didn't know how to react to that. We've all got a sense of what that battle is supposed to look like. What having the same battle with different systems allows you to do is very easily discern the kind of argument that the designer is making for his system with what's important, what's less important, what matters, what doesn't matter. Is command and control a key thing in order to get your units marshaled in the right direction? You know, you guys brought it up last night on the broadcast about the distinctions. I think Luke was talking about it, the distinctions between needing a leader to activate a unit versus needing that leader to activate a unit. And that's a system differentiation. What unit, you know, how do you activate units to move them around? That kind of command and control argument on the part of a game designer can draw a distinction between different kinds of systems. Panzer Grenadier is much more loosey-goosey about as long as you have a commander, you can activate a unit, and you can do these chain activations all the way down the line to make things happen. That's not necessarily the way things usually happen in a battle, but okay, you know, that's their version of how to do command and control, and that's very different than, you know, Panzer Blitz, which didn't have any kind of leader counters in there.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing too is, what's the designer's intent? Is the designer's intent to go out there and give you a simulation? You know, going back to the simulation versus game, you know, discussion, a simulation of Stalingrad, or is he trying to give you a game on Stalingrad? Because, well, if I can't activate these guys unless this guy's with them and he gets killed or he gets moved away, he's away from them, well, I can't activate him. What's the point? This is boring. I don't like this game. It sucks. You know?
Yeah.
So at that point, they're saying, no, let's just make it where you're playing the game. Because the more you're playing a game, the more you can enjoy it, the more you feel invested in it, the more you feel like it was a great experience. And yeah, you felt like you were in the Battle of Stalingrad.
Yeah. Well, and part of the issue of having those same topics, having Stalingrad over and over, allowing you to spend a little more time investigating the case that the designer is making, instead of having to spend your time sort of fiddling with the kind of point the designer is getting to, is if we all know that the tractor factory is an important thing in Stalingrad, or that Pavlov's house matters for this reason, then it doesn't matter what system you are using, you're still going to focus on that same piece of key terrain no matter what.
Sure.
And when you're kind of personally evaluating the system after the fact and deciding, yeah, I like the way it models this, I don't like the way it models that, because you've got a common frame of reference underneath with that same battle, hey, this is how this game modeled that battle. This is how this other game modeled that battle. I like this model better for these reasons. You're not being skewed by, oh, well, that was a battle I'd never heard of, and if only I'd done this thing differently in the fight, and you're paying more attention to the tactics than necessarily the system. It gives you that common frame of reference for comparing systems far more than messing with what's kind of inside the battles. And I think that's a valuable use of multiple games on the same topic. That's a long way around to getting to the point that I was after, but that's kind of where I was trying to go with that.
No, it's true. I mean, you can, you know, if everyone does the exact same game all the time, it's like, okay, well, do we need the 7th edition of this same game, which is essentially what this is, a 7th game on the Bulge that does the exact same thing? Well, what do you do differently in your game? You know, what's going to, is it going to be, it could be something as simple as, it's much more streamlined to play this game. Like Cells, you know, Cells, that's a pretty streamlined game. And it is a great little representation of the Battle of the Bulge that you can play in a couple of hours, you know, and it's like, okay, well, you can play Bitter Woods or Ardennes 44 and take a much longer time. And I'm not saying either one's better than the other. I'm just saying it depends on what it is you want to get out of your game and, you know, how much time you want to invest. And they all give great representations in different ways and at different game times too, you know, hour and a half to 2 hours versus 4 to 6 or 8 or more hours.
Yeah. And one of the things, you know, the Bulge games are definitely one of those places where you can see the distinctions between, okay, this game cares more about leadership, this game cares more about logistics, this game cares more about mobility, this game cares more about air cover or lack thereof. They all put different emphases in different places. And so, you know, the Bulge is a great one for comparing across a variety of modern elements within a game that, you know, many of which were completely irrelevant at something like a Gettysburg or a Waterloo. The Bulge gives you the opportunity to see what matters to that designer. Stalingrad does to a limited extent. Look, the German logistics problem is completely screwed in Stalingrad unless you're playing it at the high strategic level, even at the operational level. I just don't think there's any way to make any sort of logistical difference in Stalingrad for the Germans. So you're sort of stuck with that no matter what. Yeah. But you can make the argument of, okay, how much does leadership matter versus how much does the equipment matter, right? Does the difference in German equipment versus Soviet equipment really make that much of a difference? You can model that out a little better or have a better way of comparing how much the designers valued those things if you've already got an understanding of what Stalingrad is supposed to look like.
Sure. I mean, the whole thing that a designer wants to do is put you into that environment so that way you can virtually enjoy it and experience it in a hopefully an entertaining way. And, you know, of course, that entertaining is different to everybody. You know, some people want, you know, a lot of charts and tables. They want a lot of detail. They want all these, you know, they want a lot of bookkeeping, things like that. Some people eat that up. Other people are like, no, I just want to fight.
Yeah.
You know, so each designer goes in there, like you were saying, with a different thesis. You know, this is what we're going to go on. This is leadership's more important, or firepower's more important, whatever, and or morale, whatever it is. And as long as they get the point across in their game and they get you entertained and wanting to come back for more, that's all that matters. You know, a good example is like Mark Simic's 4X series, as I call it, the 40 series.
Yep.
He's got, you know, a great system in place, and he has taken us to everywhere. You know, he's got Normandy, there's Holland, there's Stalingrad, you know, Ardennes. It's just, there's so many great games in that one system that you can experience by playing one, learn it, and it just carries over to the other systems, and each one is unique, and each one is very, very entertaining.
Yeah. I've watched a bunch of people pushing counters around those. I've never taken a seat at the table with one of them. One of these days, sure. but it's one of those, hasn't happened yet. I was happy when I was able to get one of the fast action battles games to the table, and was able to get Fab Sicily on the table and actually bang through that a little bit.
What did you think of that game?
A lot of fun. It's a little more of an on-ramp than I expected. I think it would have been a lot more helpful to have someone there kind of over your shoulder the first couple of turns, making sure you're not necessarily that you're doing things right, but that you're thinking of the right things in the right time. Hey, now is when you need to consider adding these assets for these units to help boost this reason. It's one thing to follow along a sequence of play in a book. It's another thing to sort of have a more directed set of guidance that says, okay, now is when this thing is important and you need to make sure you use it, as a for instance.
Well, you know, war games are very unique in that way. You know, when you compare to the hobby game world, you know, you have a hobby game, any hobby game, it'll just throw out anything. You know, what was that one? Terraforming Mars, for example.
Yeah.
It's like an hour to 2 hour game. You can sit down, play it your first time, never having played it, you know, as long as you got an experienced player with you that can walk you through it, and they can kind of teach you, hey, yeah, okay, here you want to do this, here you want to do that, blah, blah, blah. You're going to grok it fairly quick, because like most Euros, it follows kind of similar patterns, so you're going to, you know, understand it a lot more. Whereas a war game, you know, you're talking 2 hours is a fast game, 4, 6, 8 hours more for a lot of these games, and 30, 40, 50 page rule books. And that's where it's great if you were to play opposed with somebody. A lot of times people don't realize with war games, when you play opposed, you're really kind of almost playing cooperative in a way, because especially if one guy has experience, the other guy does not, you're going to help each other. You say, you know, you might not want to do that because I don't know if you realize, but in this rule, you know, this is what's going to happen to your unit if they have to withdraw or something like that. So you kind of do work the problem together, and that way you can experience the whole game together. And you say, hey, why'd you do that when you're attacking me? Well, I'm going to attack you with this because of this, 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 and this, you know, the rules. So there's this cooperative attitude in the war game community that is, I think, transcends other, you know, areas of the hobby. In a really fantastic way. And I think it just really makes it a lot more fun, I think, to play war games for that reason. Now, there are some people that are hyper, you know, competitive and stuff. It's like, well, you could do that at WBC, but, you know, for the most part, unless you are playing the same guy over and over again, playing the same type of game, you both know the game, you're not going to be super competitive. You know, some people are, but generally you're not going to be. You're there for the experience and to learn the system and to have fun.
Well, and WBC also has the added tweak of many of those games are tournaments. So the whole point is to beat the other guy. You mentioned that level of competitiveness not always being as big a deal for the wargamers. That's actually something that we did find with some of the research I did when I was in grad school, the games research project. Now, this is going on like 14 years ago at this point. It does need a bit of a refresh from what we had back then. But one of the things that we identified in terms of motivations for playing among different, among the players who specified certain kinds of games as their favorites, the guys who identified wargaming as their favorites, were very interested in sort of learning from the games and the social aspect of play. It was funny that the Eurogamers, the folks who, you know, indicated those Euro-style board games as their favorites, competition was one of their primary motivating factors. They're playing to win, as opposed to the wargamers who are playing to sit down and have a good time. That was one of the things that, you know, when people start talking about the differences between wargamers and Euros and RPG players and computer game players and whatever else, like, we've got the stats to back up some of the assertions that we throw out there about those things, because we spent a whole bunch of time gathering this info and then crunching the data on it afterwards. Yeah. I got the numbers to back it up. I'm not just making it up.
Well, you know, a good example is at, you know, CSW Expo here in Dallas a month or so ago, before this virus thing kicked in. I had set up a game with another gamer who had some experience with Next War, same as me. But he was just like me. He had played the basic game. He hadn't played the advanced game yet. He looked at it, had wanted to play it. It's just, you know, it was a little bit too much to set up yourself and play through yourself. So we made the plan to, we're going to sit down together and do a cooperative learning experience game. And, you know, we were competitive against each other, trying to beat each other. But at the same time, we were helping each other through all the steps, learning the advanced steps. And it was a great experience. And we were like, oh, yeah, hey, I mean, obviously we did things that were not, you know, strategically the best choices. You know, when it came to like the air war, we're like, screw it, throw everything up there. Let's have a big giant furball. So we did that. And then we realized, oh, yeah, we probably should have saved some, you know, aircraft for strikes and for counter-strikes and things like that. Well, we didn't do that. Oh, screw it. Who cares? We can retcon it. We'll pull a couple more units in or whatever. We're experiencing the steps. We're experiencing how it all works. So that way we understand it better. And then we have time. We'll sit down and play it ourselves, or we'll meet up again in a con or play online or whatever. But at least now we have that experience. And that's something that, because of the learning curve for war games, you really do benefit. We all do benefit from working together to learn a system.
Yep. And now you sort of know what you're doing. So, you know.
Well, we think we sort of know what we're doing. We still screw up rules. That's probably one thing that wargamers have over all other areas of games, is how many times we screw up rules.
It was mentioned on a previous podcast that there was a game at Origins years ago. So my son was 6-ish, like he's 17 now, so it tells you how long ago this was. He was 6 or 7 at the time. We were walking around the exhibit hall. Captain Darwin from the Dragoons, from the CPX team, was there with us as we were just walking around through the exhibit hall, just checking some things out, and we had a break in the action. It's now called My First Carcassonne. Back then it was Kids of Carcassonne, was on one of the tables. So we sat down. They weren't running a demo at the time. They said, yeah, sure, sit down if you want. And so we sat down, we grabbed the rules, we pulled it out. Now, this thing is designed for ages like 4 and up. Okay, this is as bare bones basic as you can get, and we still managed to screw up one of the rules.
Oh yeah, that happens.
And you've got literally a rocket scientist and a PhD candidate sitting at the table together, and we managed to screw up one of the rules.
Well, I mean, there's a combination of things that happened there. One is the rule could have been written with, you know, ambiguity in it. The other is being war gamers. And, you know, being academics, you read too deeply into a rule.
That's exactly what happened. We way overthought this thing.
They really mean this, and they're insinuating. No, read it for what it says.
For exactly what it is. We read way too much into it.
Well, sometimes gamers are their own worst enemies.
Yes.
You know, overthinking it.
Yeah, we absolutely were. Speaking of overthinking it, what's the next game on your table you're going to be overthinking here?
Overthinking? Well, I've got, I have kind of toyed with Quebec 1759. I had that set up a couple weeks ago. This whole thing started happening and everyone's working from home now, so it's kind of kept me busy. I have not really messed with it as much as I wanted to and played a full game all the way through in one sitting, so I'm going to have to sit down and play. And it's not a hard game to play, it's just need the time to sit down and knock it out. One game I want to try to get on the table is They Fell Like Stones, the San Luana, which okay. is by White Dog Games. I just did a preview of that not too long ago on the channel, and I want to get that one out there. It's a solitaire game. I really have nothing on this San Luana at all. You know, I have nothing. I had Zulus on the Ramparts at one point, and I was like, yeah, it's kind of cool. And I, you know, I think I gave it away or I sold it or something. I just don't have it anymore. So it'll be good to have something that is representative of that battle. So I want to check that one out hopefully soon. And I'd like to finally get Pacific Tide on the table as well.
We have a review of Pacific Tide that will be published by the time this podcast is released. I just got an email today from one of my dudes. And so we're going to have that go up here very soon. So I'm
nice.
Looking forward to getting that one out there.
I need to get Castle Litter back on the table. I played it twice, and I have not played it since, you know, because that was all before this whole thing started. So
yep.
with COVID-19, and I need to get that back on the table because I got to do a review on it. But it's been a little nutty, you know, because everyone's been working from home, and it was that all just transpired very rapidly, where it was like, everyone's at work, you're going home. And yeah. you're going to be gone for at least 2 weeks, maybe longer. We don't know. And it's like, well, it looks like it's going to be longer than 2 weeks now. So a lot of people had to just bail and get, you know, we had to get people up and running at home and make sure that they were going. And all essential services maintained, you know, were maintained as well. So it's been kind of a hectic couple weeks. And it's starting to, knock on wood here, it's kind of starting to level out now. So hopefully yeah. I'll stay that way.
Folks didn't get a lot of on-ramp to prepare for this whole everybody go home kind of thing. So
no, it was like, hey, we're over the drop point. Pew.
Yeah.
Out the window.
Yeah.
It's like, so, damn.
Some of us who've been working from home for a little while adjusted to it a little easier, but I think there's a lot of folks that, were caught a little off guard, and it's they're starting to figure it out, but there wasn't a lot of on-ramp to figuring it out there. So.
Well, it's funny when you work from home, generally it's okay, take your laptop home, you're good. No, this was people were taking desktops home.
Yeah.
You know, that it was one of those, they were literally ripping it out of the wall and, well, not ripping it out of the wall, but taking it out of the wall and then carrying a monitor and a computer out to their car to go home, set up on VPN and do their work. And we were not expecting to have that kind of a load as most companies weren't, because, you know, you have your mobile users, you have the people that are in the office all the time. So it was, that was a little bit of an adjustment too. So, I think everyone's going through the same growing pains, but I think it is a good experience as far as, how much work can actually be done from home versus in the office? And how many hours do people work when they're working at home versus when they're in the office?
Yeah.
You know, because they're a lot more reachable when they're at home.
And how much of what you were doing in the office really needed to be in the office to get done?
Oh, yeah. Most of it does not need to be done in the office. You know, it's just one of those things where, I mean, I'm up at 5:30 and I'm generally, you know, 5:30, between 5:30 and 6, I get up, I get my coffee, and I'm usually on my computer between 6 and 6:30 and I'm answering emails and I'm doing stuff. And it's like, that's not even my start time, but that's what I'm doing. And then I get done with this, I'll be checking emails before I go to bed. So it's like, I don't do that normally, but now that I'm working from home, yeah, I'll do that. I mean, I do answer emails after hours, but not really that often. But now it's here. You know, I'm going to go in there and I'll do stuff that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily do before. So working from home, you actually, you know, I think you're more accessible to your job than you are when you're in the office.
Oh, hell yeah. No, that is a definite,
the case. Not just being pushed, but you're on your own. You're just checking things. You're like, oh, my computer's right here. Let me check and see, are these servers running, everything, you know, running good on this? You know, we've been concerned about this. Or, hey, did that person answer that email? Let me fire off another email at 11:30 at night. You know, it's just one of those things that you do and you don't think anything of it. And especially with, you know, situation, everyone's a little more, you know, paying a lot more attention now because it's an uncertain time right now for everybody.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of folks that are going to have to rapidly adjust to the idea of how to set some boundaries for themselves, or they're going to hit a burnout wall very, very quickly. You know, again, I think it's one of those things that folks that have done a lot of working from home in the past are a lot more used to and a lot more comfortable with doing that. I've got no problem walking away from the computer at 5:30 and saying, I'm done. Like, you want to talk to me? I'll be back online at 8 a.m. One other thing, the last thing I wanted to cover with us here is we're still kind of ironing out some details between us, but I'm hoping that by the time this podcast goes live, we will have ironed some of those things out. We've got some collaborations of some sorts upcoming between us and hoping to get Dan from No Enemies Here involved in it, hoping to get Gary over at Aardwolf's Lair involved in it in terms of some content sharing, some promotional stuff across each other. I'm throwing out there, one of the things we're going to be doing over at the Dragoons is we're going to be starting a Tuesday news drop kind of thing that we're going to be, you know, highlighting some of the content coming in from your guys' channels. You know, like you'd said, everybody's stuck at home. Everybody's got some time on their hands and some computers accessible. So let's help them find some other cool content to check out. And so we're going to be, you know, showcasing some of the stuff from you guys alongside some new product announcements alongside, hey, here's a new thing on Kickstarter you guys should check out. Linking to Dan's videos every week when he drops his new No Enemies Here videos. We're going to be putting those up on our site so folks can find them there. I'm hoping that sort of this kind of network, look, I hate the corporate term synergy, right? But that is kind of what we're going for, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the when I first posted my idea, the whole intent of my thought was we don't have a network, you know, like a Wargamers network, for lack of a better term. You know, we'll call it like, you know, you have the ABC network, CBS network, whatever. We don't have a Wargamers network. And it would be neat to have something like that where it's like an aggregation of all of the different, you know, content creators out there are all put together to say, hey, here's what everybody does. And it can even be broken down. If you want it to get crazy, you can break it down into here's replays, here's, you know, unboxings, here's reviews, whatever. So live plays or playthroughs, things like that. So that way everybody can shine the light on everybody, all the content creators out there, because there are a lot more content creators in the war game space than a lot of people realize. And I think it would be great to get some of these guys that have, you know, they have a channel, they only got 40 subscribers, but they're putting out great content. Why not shine a light on them? Say, hey, check out Joe over here. He's got a great little, you know, channel. It's just starting up and he's got, you know, really good attitude and he's got good content. Motivate them to do more, because I mean, if you go out there and you put content up and you're doing this on your own time, on your own dime, and you're got 40 subscribers, how motivated are you to keep putting out content? You know, over time you're going to hit burnout. You're going to say, "Yeah, I'm tired. This is no one cares." They do care, but not as many people care as you'd like to see. So if we can, you know, get everybody to get a lot more attention, it's not necessarily, and no one's trying to win here. Everyone wins with everyone getting attention. So if we can get everybody to get eyes on different content that people are putting out there, I think it's great. And I think it's a win-win for everybody. And right now, everyone's home, so check out what everybody's doing. There's a lot of great content creators out there putting out stuff for us to enjoy.
Yeah, and so that's part of what we're going to be trying to help highlight with folks, and that we want people sort of paying some more attention to, and that's kind of what we're going to do. And so part of it is, what are we each doing? Part of it is, let's all help each other mass fires to help highlight some of these guys like you're talking about. Also, it doesn't hurt, I think, if we can share some scheduling info across the sites of when something's coming out, like you guys going live last night. The only reason I knew that you guys were going live last, I mean, I would have seen it on your Twitter feed when you said, hey, we're about to go live with whatever. But the only reason I knew a couple days in advance was I asked you, hey, you want to record a podcast on Tuesday? And you said, I can't, I'm going to be live online. So, yeah. You know, to be able to get some of that stuff, pushed out and hyped up a little bit ahead of time. Look, Saturday nights, we're going live with Saturday Night Fights, right? Every week, 8 o'clock, 8 Eastern, 7 Central, we're live with Saturday Night Fights, because Cyrano's got that set aside in his schedule, and he's going to be doing it every time. And so if you want to see some live wargaming, come check us out. You know, Dan's not going live with No Enemies Here, but we know when those are going to be released. But is there, you know, a more defined schedule on when Whiskey Charlie's hitting every week? And let's make sure people know about that, that they're able to tune in and check it out. So.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we're doing that. We've got 6 episodes into the new show, Whiskey Charlie. And it's just something that I had been thinking about wanting to do. And I talked to Nate and Dan about it. I said, hey, let's do a show. And they were like, yeah, I think it'll be cool. I said, let's give it a little experiment for episode 1. And it worked pretty well. And I was like, okay, you know, we're just finding our footing on it and stuff, as like all shows do. You start off and you have to get a feel for it, let the show grow organically and get your own personality. And that's where we're getting now. And we're getting some good guests on, really fun to talk with different people and get a lot of audience interaction. Cause that's the big key right there to me, is if you're going to have a live show, well, you need to be having people, you know, ask questions and highlight them in the chat and show them, so everybody can see that the question is, and have the guest answer it, or one of us answer it if there's no guest or whatever, and then just have a bull session about war games and about life and whatever. Have some fun, distract people, and, you know, for an hour, 2 hours. Sometimes we've had longer ones, like on to 3, you know, but have some fun, you know, and right now, distract people, because everyone's stuck at home. Have some fun and let's just talk war games.
Yeah, exactly. And look, that's always been the ethos of our podcast here, is what would happen if you set a tape recorder down on the bar with a couple of gamers hanging around talking games. That's
depends on how much they're drinking.
Yeah, well, there's that. And we've had a couple of podcast folks that were definitely imbibing during the podcast. That's absolutely happened in the past. But that's always, and look, tonight was a perfect example. We didn't have an agenda. Let's just show up and talk some games.
Yeah.
So, and we've managed to get an hour and 15 minutes out of this, which,
there you go.
By the time I edit it down, we're probably going to come closer to, you know, hour 10, hour 8 or so, you know, once I edit out a bunch of the ums and the awkward pauses, that's what we'll end up
nice.
With. But this has been fun. You know, it's not quite Whiskey Charlie because we don't have the video going, which, thank God, because I needed a haircut before COVID shut down all the barbershops, right? I was a month overdue before that got shut down. I'm going to look like I belong in the 70s here before too long.
Did you not see this coming? I mean, did you not realize that, you know, there's something that's going to happen pretty soon, time to get the haircut?
No, I knew. I just didn't care. When you work from home, there's a certain there's a certain part at which you just don't care. But now you're sort of doing the comparison between how much shampoo's left in the bottle and how much your hair's growing out, and you're like, "Well, crap."
Well, I'm thinking already, going, "Wow, it's like, okay, I'm 2 weeks into my haircut, or since my last haircut, and I normally get my haircut like every 4 weeks. I just always keep my hair short, so it's like, oh wow, I'm going to look like a hippie, you know, for my standards. By the time we're able to get a haircut, you know, it may not be for another month or two. So, who knows? I may have to break out the clippers and do it myself, and hopefully." The good thing is if we're still home, it won't matter because I'll butcher my hair and no one will notice.
Nobody will see. Before every annual training summer, I would always go into the barber and I'd sit down and I'd say, I want it skin up to the ears and the number two guard on top. And they'd look at me like I was crazy. I'm like, look, I'm headed to the field for 3 weeks. Like, I'm going to be running around in a Kevlar at Fort Stewart, Georgia in, you know, 89 degrees and 140% humidity. I don't want hair under the helmet to have to take care of. I just don't. Nope. Just take it off. And I kind of wish I'd done that like 3 weeks ago now.
Yeah, that's the way I looked at it. I kind of did have that, you know, almost kind of had that. I should have gone shorter on the top and gone with like a 2 rather than a 4. But I was like, yeah, I'll go with a 4 this time. It's like, then I'm like, nah, I should have gone with a 2. I should have gone like, hey, I'm going to the desert. It's time to, you know, shave my head really short, because this is like kind of like going into a field situation in the way when you look at, you're not going to have a haircut, access to a haircut for a while. So, either way, you know, it'll be what it is, and everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah. Hey, look, nobody's hiring me or consulting me for my looks, so I'm not really worried about the haircut. So, and if they are, they are in way more trouble than I'm going to be able to get them out of. That's just reality right there. Mo, thank you very much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun, and one of these days I'm going to totally crash your Whiskey Charlie show.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely want to get you on. Let me know when you can come on, and you have to have video. So that's the part of the show. It's a live show. Everyone's having fun. Everyone wants to see each other. So we definitely want to get you on. We'd appreciate having you on, and I appreciate being on your show. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, I'll have the video, but I'm going to have a light shining from the back of my head, so it's all silhouette. With the giant helmet hairdo going right now, so
we're gonna be like, we're gonna have you, instead of, you know, Brant, we're gonna say Deep Throat.
Yeah,
all you're gonna see is just a shadow of you.
The shadow, and I'll get the auto tune for the voice. You know,
there you go.
All right, audience, thank you for joining us. This has been Mentioned in Dispatches as Crashed by Whiskey Charlie and Mo from Mo's Game Table. Definitely go check out Mo's Game Table. It's a ton of fun. And we'll make sure we get, you know, once you've got your schedule of when some of those live episodes are going out, we'll make sure we start pointing people there so they can join the interactive fun that happens there instead of just the one-way broadcast that we've got going on here at Mentioned in Dispatches. Don't forget Saturday Night Fights. Come check us out on Saturday evenings. Again, that's 8 Eastern, 7 Central. Tune in and watch us doing some wargaming. You're not seeing video of us. You're just seeing the game on Tabletop Simulator. But we do interact with the chat quite a bit. We got a handful of regulars, but we're always happy to have other folks come join us and chat and, you know, learn about the game. And we're always happy to answer questions while the game is going on. And then, you know, swing by the site and say hi in the forums. In the meantime, everybody have a great day. Stay well. Stay undercover, social distancing, all that good stuff. But now is a great chance to play a lot of games, so take advantage of it.